Welcome back. This is the Coaches Rising podcast, and I think this is a really important conversation. I'm joined by Stacey Haynes today, and we're going to explore how can we take positive action in the world, action oriented around creating positive transformation without creating further polarization or adding to the problem. And Stacey has created the Out at Work project with several others to empower people to do this, how to act in the world without creating further polarization. And I must admit, when I was first invited to support this project, I felt resistant because of that potential. And I wanted to remain more apolitical. And actually, the journey I went through was I recognized that I was bypassing. And actually, of course, there's an absolute need for action in the world and for political action too. Hopefully that political action is rooted in love and a sense of serving the greatest whole. And so this is a really vulnerable podcast because in this we share I share my resistances and some of the criticisms I've had with the liberal upbringing that I've had, the liberal worldview. And I think Stacey just embodies so beautifully what she's talking about by the vulnerabilities that we share, bringing us into deeper connection and mutual understanding. So it's all about, you know, what is the role of somatics and our inner work in supporting us to be able to do outer work more effectively without creating more polarizations. What a great topic for our times. So a few more words about Stacey. She is a masterful coach, a pioneer in the field of somatics, working at the intersection of trauma healing, embodied leadership, and social justice, teaching internationally, the author of The Politics of Trauma, Somatics, Healing, and Social Justice, and another book, Healing Sex, A Mind-Body Approach to Healing Sexual Trauma. And she's also a senior teacher at the Strozzi Institute. Let's dive right in. I don't have to tell you that these are turbulent times. They're astonishing times. Many people are feeling deeply challenged, more reactive, and my sense is in more need of coaching than ever. And while these times are full of challenges, they're also ripe with evolutionary potential. This is the gift of these times. And I think it's these moments that coaches are built for, so we can help our clients unlock the deeper capacities and intelligence that's required of them now. And that's exactly what our newest program, Unlocking Leaders, is all about. You'll learn how to work at the source code of change, beyond strategy, beyond protocol, at the level of consciousness itself. This, for me, has been by far the biggest leverage I have with my clients. It's the most potent move I can make, because the level of consciousness a leader is operating from determines everything. What they notice, what they miss, whether they react defensively, stay grounded, whether they tighten in control or open into creativity and collaborativity, and ultimately what becomes possible in how they lead. And when you work at this level, you'll be able to tap into these hidden drivers behind decisions and behaviors and unlock possibilities in situations that once felt stuck. And beyond that, importantly, you're going to cultivate a capacity that AI will never possess. As AI expands and begins to dominate procedural and operational coaching, as it grows, it's becoming clearer what it cannot do. And it can't feel, it can't connect in the same way when two human beings come together and the field that they create becomes part of the transformational conversation. It can't work with consciousness, the very source of transformation and the source of the most powerful coaching moves. This is what separates good coaches from great coaches working at this level. And AI can't touch this. So if you're interested to find out more about this program, if you feel called to join us, then head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. The first class is June 16th with Jim Dethmer, just an incredible, masterful coach. And he's joined by Bob Anderson, also a true pioneer in the field of conscious leadership and coaching. And if you sign up by May 29th, you can get the early bird discount. Enrollment is open until June 12th. So head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot.
Stacey, it's very good to be with you today. And as I was saying before we hit the record button, I'm excited about our topic. I think it's going to be a rich topic and maybe even a little vulnerable to explore. But I love that about being in connection with you. It's like, I feel like we always can just get into stuff. So how are you, first of all?
I'm really glad to do this too. Like, I've really appreciated our conversations that led up to this. So I'm looking forward to a just heartfelt conversation together. And how I am, I'm good. I'm actually on with my family in Colorado right now where I grew up. But I'll tell you, I can feel the altitude. It's like walk up the steps and then I'm out of breath. So I'm adjusting.
It's kind of cool, isn't it? That we can visit places like that. Maybe to begin with, we're going to talk about the Outer Work project today, why you're creating this and what it is. And I think that's, you know, will lead to some really interesting kind of questions. Could you say to people listening, just in a couple of sentences, like what you do, and then tell us about what the Outer Work project is?
For sure. So I am 30 plus years in the field of somatics or embodied transformation. And then at this point, I call it sometimes politicized somatics, like a somatics that acknowledges the social conditions and how they shape us. I do coaching, I do teaching, and I work a lot with organizations inside of social change and climate.
Beautiful. And so, yeah, I got this email from you, you know, last year inviting to kind of support this project, the Outer Work project, which I think even the title is quite revealing. Could you say like what the Outer Work project is, why you created it?
Yeah. You know, as many of us, we spend a lot of our coaching and somatic and in body transformation time online these last 5 and 6 years out of the pandemic. And one thing I heard people say over and over again is like, I really care, but I don't know what to do about the bigger social issues. And I've been a person who cares deeply about internal cultivation, healing, transformation, and I care a lot about what's happening in our societies, economies. So the Outer Work Project is really a bridge between those two things. Like, how do we invite people who've really cared about the inner work, about coaching, about trauma healing, and invite them into a project or a process that lets them know what the kind of levers of social change are, and then how to engage in a positive way in a social change? You know, I think of that about it as life-affirming social change. Like, what's a society and economy that we want to hand over to our grandkids or to the next generations that we actually feel proud of instead of apologetic for?
How will you, what's the intention of the project? How will you bring about this, you know, life-affirming change?
That's the question. that is all of our questions. So, there's a political scientist who I really respect right now. Her name is Erica Chenoweth. She's at Harvard, and she studies authoritarianism and fascism. And obviously, there's a trend in our broader world toward authoritarianism right now. And in her study, she really looks at if 3.5% of a population is mobilized toward social change, toward social democracy, toward equity and taking care of the environment, that there's a very high success rate at either preventing authoritarianism or actually changing it. And I sit in the United States, and we are in a place right now that is leaning toward authoritarianism. And so the Outer Work Project is really kind of doing my part of mobilizing 3.5%. So that's 9 million people in the United States. Now, the Outer Work Project itself is not going to mobilize 9 million, but I really wanted to create a very welcoming, depthful space that invites people again who care and who've really done self-cultivation or healing or coaching to almost like scale up to the next level of care where we're like, okay, I care about social change. how do I join to make a bigger difference? At the end of the Outer Work project, we'll help people basically partner or fit in with social change organizations that are aligned with what they care about and with their values. So it might be that someone comes through and they really care about voting rights. Great, we're going to connect them to a voting rights organization. And we're asking everyone to then engage 5 to 20 hours a month to, as a volunteer, right? To be a part of making a bigger difference. Folks don't have to change their work, or it's just like, it's amazing really how a few hours a month adds up to growing that 3.5% and together getting to make a bigger difference.
What's the, before I share a little bit about my, some thoughts I have in my journey with your, you know, your email reaching out, let's just, could you say something first about somatics and what somatics has to offer in service of that kind of change that you think is really important?
Yeah, I really thank you so much for even knowing to ask that question. So two things. It took me a while to really understand that our social conditions, the social norms, the economies that we operate inside of deeply shape us somatically. And we wouldn't think that because mostly we relate to our more personal experiences or interpersonal experiences or how we are shaped by our families or communities. And so when I, you know, in this passion of mine of connecting personal and social transformation, when I really engage more and learned more about social transformation, I saw how much we often embody things that aren't even aligned with our own values from the social norms. Or when we go to take on more leadership or get actively involved, sometimes those things are limitations. Like, let me just give one example because I know we're going to talk about it today. Most of us didn't learn how to hold complexity without moving into taking a position and taking a rigid position. Instead of being able to hold contradiction and complexity, you know, somatics is really good at helping us know how to hold or learn how to hold complexity without polarizing. Another example might be, let's say we're hurt by social norms. Let's say we're hurt by homophobia, or we're hurt by sexism, or we're hurt by racism. That hurt is a kind of trauma that actually needs healing and needs attention to then go, how does my leadership not be driven by my trauma, but rather be driven or inspired by a vision? Does that make sense?
Totally, yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe that kind of is a good segue. I think what you're talking about, we're just touching the surface of, and I'd like to spend quite a good portion of our conversation, you know, going deeper into what you've talked about just now. But I think you've just opened up, like, the, you know, when you reached out to me, you know, I said, like, let me think about this, Stacey, because, you know, the initial response I had was, I want to be part of things that don't reinforce that sense of polarization. And so, you know, I was like, where are you coming from with this initiative, and what is the ideology behind it? And it's been a really powerful journey, because I feel like a commitment to taking action from a place of vision and a sense of what will serve the whole, you know, the diversity, but also the unity of the whole. And what I saw was that I think I was caught in a little bit of spiritual bypassing, in a sense of that I was also resisting the need, actually, that we do take action, and that part of that action is political, you know. So it seems, you know, as you've named, like, there's been an increasing sense of polarization over the last decade, 15, 20 years, who's, you know, maybe with, particularly with social media coming on strongly and exacerbating that issue. And as I shared with you before, like, I wonder even if the backlash right now in the US in particular has been over the last few years with, you know, critical race theory and certain ideologies which have been labeled woke. And I think, you know, in a derogatory sense, you know, so yeah, anyway, I'm kind of getting to it. It's like, it's complex and I feel the call to take action, but I also don't want to take action in a way that's like othering people and actually just reinforcing the very issue.
Right. Okay. You said so many important things. So I'm just going to, well, we can just dig into this. First of all, I think a lot of us who are drawn toward healing and transformation are really drawn toward a kind of harmony and possibility. And that sometimes looking at the very difficult pain of the world is hard. I think many of us in this work are really sensitive people, and to really face the world and go, oh my God, there is so much poverty. Like, there is concentration of wealth in a way that hurts so many other people. Like, to really face it is very, very painful. And I think when you talked about spiritual bypass, I think understandably, it's also a good survival strategy, but many of us will go toward the hope of unity, the possibility, not wanting to get into, quote, the politics, right? Which we mean many different things by that, but not wanting to get into the hurt, the polarization, the backbiting, the throwing stuff at each other that world of politics can often look like. So I just want to stop with that for a minute, because one of the tricky things about both, I think, engaging deep internal change and engaging social change is there are moments where we have to pause and face the pain of things. And I think that part just hurts. It's like, oh, well, that's not what I want, or that's really painful to feel, or how did that just happen to my neighbor? And to me, in some ways, coaching and somatics help us grow our capacity to pause and let things in, face things, let ourselves feel and process pain. Now, we don't want to get lost there, but it is one of the parts of responding to our world rather than reacting or bypassing our world, right? So I want to move to the second piece, but is there anything you want to say about that?
Well, no, I think it's well said, and I'd love to just, like, yeah, keep you in your flow, and yeah, trust we'll kind of weave it all together.
Yeah. When we talk about polarization, I want to think about it in a couple of ways. If we look at it through a transformational lens or a somatic lens, we can understand polarization as kind of a survival strategy, where it's just like, I can't deal with that, or I can't face that, or I can't feel safe with something that feels very different and unknown to me. So I'm going to pull over and I'm going to polarize against that as a way to find safety, belonging, or dignity in some kind of way. None of us like being shamed or made wrong. Right? Like, we have a self-preservation in us that wants to fight for our own dignity or fight for our own safety. So if we look at it as a healthy, not like we want to get stuck there, but as a survival strategy that makes sense, to me, it's a real ground for compassion. If we look at polarization more through a lens of power and people or institutions trying to gain power, polarization gets used as a way to make another group bad or wrong and to, in some way, disempower them in some way. Now, I think it gets used all the time throughout history politically. I mean, we could look at apartheid South Africa. We could look at the era of Nazi Germany. We can look at our current politics. It's like, what group, people, or nation is being made wrong to validate a polarization or a taking over or a power over move to that group. Yeah. So I think we have to be nuanced in which polarization we're talking about. Are we talking about the personal, emotional self-preservation? I want to have dignity and belong. Or are we talking about the concentration of power polarization? And of course, they both get used together. So I just want to say, you know, I'm white, a woman. I grew up in the United States. And I grew up working class. I'm middle class now, but I grew up working class. And I really watched the current U.S. administration use class and race to polarize and move a certain segment of the population into a more authoritarian perspective and invent that phrase wokeness. Yeah. I also saw some of the people who were really fighting for racial justice, gender justice, polarize in a way that made other people bad. And I think it was a not good strategy. You know, when I go, what's at our heart? If equity is at our heart, it's like we have to, this is my view, make a transformative path available for everyone. So I look at some of the men I grew up with, like working class white men who worked their butts off their entire life. And they also got trained in a certain racist perspective because of growing up in the US, like somehow white is supposed to be better. But when I listen to those men and they're like, why do these people have more education than me? Why do these people who came to this country after me have more power, economics? The only reason handed to them to understand it is a pretty racist, right, orientation, right? And they're like, I'm white, I should have blah, 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 because they weren't handed an understanding of class. And it's like, oh, well, you didn't get that education because you're working class. And sadly, this concentration of wealth depends on you staying pretty poor. That understanding wasn't given to folks, and instead an understanding of race was, and now suddenly they're all anti-immigrant. Anyway, is this making any sense? These are the subtleties we're trying to grapple with.
Yeah, because could you not say the same has been used by diverse communities to make it about race rather than class? Anyway, you know, that's probably a moot point, but mechanism has been used by the other side, but you know, the other groups, yeah, who've said this is about race rather than class.
So here's what's really, to me, there's like a hairball in here that we want to really be able to unpack. Maybe that's a terrible metaphor, but I see it as like a knot that we want to unpack. In, again, I'm going to talk about kind of understanding social change. There's something called, people have probably heard it, an intersectional analysis, and it really came from what's called third wave feminism, which was really in the 80s and 90s. But it said, it basically talked about power over versus power with. And in some ways, I think it's the radical transformation that we're all grasping for. Is what if no group had to be on top? What if power over wasn't our broad, what do you call it? Our, help me out here. It's like our mythos, right? Like who's dominating whom? What if power over wasn't our mythos? What if it was power with? Now, an intersectional analysis is just trying to understand power and going, hey, what about the system keeps Black and Indigenous people oppressed over and over and over again, generation after generation globally? What is it about our systems that keep wealthy people making most of the global decisions over and over and over again? Now, not all those wealthy people are white, but there's a majority that are white, even if we just look at nation states, right? Now, sometimes when I get into these conversations, it just makes people's heads hurt because it's not where they spent their time, right? So I want to just keep acknowledging, like, let's drop back into our hearts. What is it that we long for all beings? What is it that we long for the people we love most? And mostly what we long for is like a healthy, happy life in which they have a lot of opportunities and have good people connection, good spiritual connection, and there's a healthy environment for them to grow up in, right? So what I want to say, last thing I want to say about this is one of the things that I think got kind of sideways in this last wave of like a, let's call it a fight for racial justice, is I think it got really tripped up in American individualism. We are like the king and queen of individualism. It's like me, 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 me. Right? And we don't have a we. We don't have a like, oh, the commons and what would be good for the we. It's why social democracy is almost a bad word in the United States, which you're not of the United States. You don't live in the United States. You understand some of the benefits of social democracy. Like people have healthcare. What a radical idea, right? But I think some of the ideologies that we're going for power with got caught up in a kind of individualism where suddenly we're pointing the finger at individual people and being like, you're so bad and there's no place for you in the future. No one can sustain that. We all need a dignified, belonged place where we see ourselves in the future. And I think it's one of the things we need to get good at is what's our vision of power with where everybody gets a role. I'll close with this. So Van Jones, who probably many people know, I've known him for whatever. I mostly knew him in the 90s. But he said when he was talking about the environment, he said there's really three options that humanity has. We have ecocide, where we, right? Very sad. I don't want that for us. He said we have eco-apartheid, where a certain class and race and sadly gender of people concentrate most resources and will move to all the resilient points on the planet or will go to Mars, right? But there's eco-apartheid where only some people have access to a healthy environment and others are dying first, drowning first, burning first, right? Or we have eco-democracy where we all get taken care of and the earth gets taken care of. Now, my vote is the last one, right? That, to me, that's the power with. Yeah. Okay. That was a lot. How you doing?
Yeah. No, it's good. First of all, I can notice the parts of me that respond as you share, you know, like, being of the demographic, like a white male that often is the center of like, attacks, you know, as being and like I think undignified attacks, dehumanized, you know. So
right,
many men in my generation I think grew up with a sense that, you know, masculinity is like not a healthy thing, you know, that
yeah.
Men so there's all kind of baggage that I accumulated, and then on top of that came this, you know, wave of criticism about toxic masculinity, about white privilege, which felt like it just kind of flattened everything and removed the kind of, you know, the poverty that my grandparents grew up in, you know, and that when I looked into it, it seemed like class was the real issue over race, that, you know, and I have limited knowledge in this, but, you know, seeing that there are black communities that thrive in the US, you know, and that it was more about class than race. Anyway, so that's where I start to get out of my realm of knowledge. So I want to be careful about saying things I don't know enough about. I think where I go right now is, what is the way we can work with power with? Let me see if I can get to my question. It's like, you know, I read Arturo Escobar's Designs for the Pluriverse, which I think is a, you know, beautiful book, where he's talking about, he's challenging the that we have, you know, a kind of one version of modernity. Modernity is given one version of like a design of what society, right, reality should be, you know, and it's that's colonized the whole planet. But what we need is like a diversification of different, you know, the pluriverse, you know, different societies that can, and the marginalized are coming into the center. And it's a beautiful vision. And so I'm sharing that because I get to the question of like, how can we start to enact this, you know, to use, I think, Charles Eisenstein's phrase, like the better future our hearts know is possible, with a power, with kind of modality, when it seems so complex. And, you know, I'm afraid of like unintended consequences of my actions. But I think we've spoken to that already quite some. But anyway, did I give you enough there to...
Totally.
You know, in a sense, totally, to simplify, totally. How can we work with power with, and what's the role of somatics in that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going to go back for a minute to the class race piece. This is one of the places where I think all of us who care about healing and internal work, that, you know, we want to hold that and then kind of be able to look at the world as it is on, you know, if we look at class, race, gender, right? And one of the things that helped me so much in my own learning around this, so there's a scholar, her name is Chandra Mohanty, and she was one of the third wave feminist writers. Bell Hooks, people probably know. But it talks about the power over uses lots of different levers to keep the power over intact. And race is one, class is one, gender is one. You know, it's so funny, like women are 51% of the global population and we still make, I don't know, we're like 72 cents on every man's dollar for the same work. We're like, how is that happening still? Like, I know that's not your ethic. That's not my ethic. And then the same thing, you can look at the same thing around race. It's like Black and Indigenous people incarcerated more levels of poverty globally. So sometimes we have to just look at like, wait, what's the what is? And we have to dig under the spin a little bit to look. But to kind of go, what are the levers that keep power over intact? And then how do we use those levers and more to come into our power with? So I'm wondering if before I go on, if I could ask you a question.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Please.
Okay. Also, the U.S. hates talking about class because it pretends it's a classless society. So it will never talk about class, which is one of our other struggles. It's like, it's hard to talk about class and there's a lot of individualism and we have to keep breaking that up to be able to understand more about the what is, about how power is distributed, how dignity is distributed, how safety is distributed. Yeah. Here's my question for you. And then I want to get back into the vision piece, but in a power with world or in your own heart's desire of what we have, like what do you see and how do you see the life of you and your community?
Could you say that last part? How do I see in my community?
Like your like what's your life, what's your community's life in power with? Like what does it look like and how would it actually serve you?
It's a great question. And my first response is I need to think about that more. What comes up is this is just a very personal response. Yeah. So if I try and kind of think more globally in our community, it gets a bit more difficult. But power with is for me this, the very life force of life evolving in response to life itself. That sounds a little bit, what I mean by that is, I feel very moved by two or more people coming together around a shared sense of inspiration and passion and vision. And that is the inner work that I've done has allowed me to move more deeply into that process in a way that isn't about what you said, power over. It's not to say this doesn't happen, but it happens less, you know, that it's like there's less ego involved. There's more sense of like, this is my unique signature, my music to play in this scenario. And I see yours. I see the beauty of yours. So I'm aware of my own bias, but it's like I tend not to look through the lens of race and gender and more at the beautiful uniqueness of each individual person. But there is a sense of dissatisfaction in that answer as well, Stacey. It's like I'm aware that like I'd like to grow my awareness of the systemic aspect of where you point to with that question. And yeah, so let me pause there.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you even like having a felt sense of your answer and then going, oh, I have more of a personal answer. And then I'm like scaling up that imagination of power with, it's like, it's a practice. It's like building a muscle. Because most of us have like, especially those of us in coaching or transformative work, we're like in this deep study of how do people change and how do individuals change and how do relationships change. But we're not in the study of like, I don't know, how does a global economy change? Right? That's a huge question. There's people who spend their entire lifetimes on that question, which is why we kind of want to like listen to them or connect with them or, right? We want to, like what you said, bring our unique music and then listen to other people's unique music. And, you know, because we know each other, I really trust in you when you say, you know, I'm listening for someone's music. I'm not looking through race or gender. That I believe in your heart. And then what's so interesting, if I just talk about myself, is the world has always looked at my gender. Like if I just go my own lived experience, and then I could give you like 2 million examples, but I'm deeply shaped by how the world interpreted my gender over and over and over and over again and told me who I could be and who I could not be, or how I'm going to be treated economically or in college or sexual violence, you know? So it's kind of like this thing of the yes and. And I know that's true along race. I know it's true along class. And I think sometimes, and you know this, but when we're more considered the norm, we can less consider what it is to be outside the norm. Like I really had to understand, I grew up in the 70s and I'm like, post-civil rights, we solved racism, everybody's equal. That's how I was trained, right? And then when I realized that wasn't true at all, it was a real confrontation to go, oh no, this is terrible. This is so set in. There's a lot for me to unlearn and then a lot for me to relearn. But to me, all of our inherent worth, belongingness, need for safety, how do we hold that sacred in whatever change we do? I think as coaches and therapists, we know to hold that as sacred. And how do we also learn how to hold it as sacred in the context of doing broader change work, right?
Yeah, this is really good because like, I don't want to labor the point, but
it's okay.
Also feel like that message I grew up with, you know, like men treat women like sexual objects. Men are violent. Men are toxic. And I feel like that message is amplified. So I look on like newspapers like The Guardian, which in one way I like to read, but you know, so many of their articles are critical of men. It's very interesting. I think it's a blind spot. And I hear people making very coherent arguments about the difference between the earnings between men and women, which I can't articulate here, but it takes into account women taking time out of work for pregnancy. People like Will Farrell, who talks about young men, you know, who are now falling behind in earnings to women. Men under 30 earn less than women. They're attending higher education. Their suicide rates are a lot higher. So, but when he brought that to the groups, he was basically excluded, shunned out of those groups because. So that, and I don't share. I'm not sharing that to kind of make a counter argument to like, see, it's the. But why I'm sharing it is because it's very, to me, it's very nuanced and. Let me say it like this: like, how is when we talk about intersectionality, how efficacious is that in moving to that place of power? With does it like almost immediately? It's too easy for people to feel very subtly othered. Mm-hmm. So again, I'm careful not to belabor the point here because I actually think that we want to talk about. Thematics and power with, I think that's where we want to go quite quickly, but it's I think I'm sharing it because it's something I wrestle with a lot. And
First of all, I so appreciate your vulnerability. I really appreciate just how honestly you're bringing yourself to the conversation. And let me see where I want to respond. So you could see how, which we're not going to do, but you and I could easily get into a argument of facts where we're like, well, like we could easily get into that. And in some ways there would be, it would be understandable. Right. And then what I think is so powerful about kind of having done so much internal work, right, this field is we can go underneath and go, okay, hold on. What's the core concern? So I have a son who's in his 30s, and I have heard him say so many times, what kind of man am I supposed to become? And to me, it's a beautiful question. It's such a beautiful question because I think in some ways, so just so you know, social change tends to happen in 50-year arcs. So we have to back up and we have to look at a really different arc of time. And again, in the U.S., if we go civil rights, certain parts of the women's movement, gay rights, there was a huge upsurge in the late 60s and 70s. And here we are 50 years later, Black Lives Matter, trans rights, gay people can get married in some states, right? We go, okay, here's 50 years. Now, every time, and then also the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and right now, all of that's getting gutted by our current administration, right? So I'm looking at a 50-year arc. Now, if I look at gender and men, I feel like one of the things that happened too quietly, because it did happen, is kind of going, how do we want to understand gender instead? And how do we give like a beautiful, life-affirming, belonging understanding of gender to everyone? Because if all we do is either reify traditional male roles or say masculinity is toxic, there's no place to go. There's no positive future that goes, oh, in power with, I get to be a more whole human being as a man. In power with, I get to be deeply sensitive and strong. In power with, I get to know and not know. Right. In power with, I get to, well, you get the point. You get to a wider range to be a full human. That's what I want for you. That's what I want for my son. Right. That's what I want for all of us, actually. But that, it's almost like in the battle for freedom, right? It became a polarizing battle for freedom. Now, it was happening. There were people doing men's work. There were people generating other visions, but it wasn't very loud and it didn't scale to the level that other things did. But I know we can't make each other bad on the road to freedom. And if we keep othering each other, You know what I mean? And we also, like, when we have more privilege, whether it's race, class, nation state, whatever, we have to build the somatic capacity to pause and listen really deeply to go, oh, wow, that is that person's experience. And it's not an let me just listen really deeply without dropping into being made bad, making myself bad. You know what I mean? I feel like all sides of this have work to do on not basically othering, because it won't get us there.
Could you say more about then, because I think this is really important. You're naming the what I'm hearing is, like, as we do our inner work, we become more self-aware. We maybe notice those sites of shaping, you know, the our culture and the norms that maybe have impacted us, traumatic experiences. So we can become aware of those, where we bring love to those, we're maybe less driven from those in the stance we take, and also our capacity to remain in complexity and, you know, in an embodied contact with others feels like it will improve. Could you say more about, and so, yeah, we've had these movements that haven't scaled. What do you see is needed for this power with to scale, to take root, and the role of somatics in that? I mean, you've already been talking about that, but I think there's more to say.
Yeah. So let me see. I'm going to go three things here. One is, what capacities do we need to cultivate in ourselves to be fully human? And to, like, let me see, to be fully human and to lift other people up. To me, that's like a question to meditate on for my whole life. It's like, I want to be able to love deeply and be loved deeply. I want to be able to hold complexity and really recognize when I'm going into my own reactivity, like someone shaming me, I'm going to start defending myself. Or do you know what I mean? Like, really have more and more capacity to be present with my own reactivity, not abandon myself, but not go full force into reactivity, right? I want to really look deeply at, let's say, even groups of people who, for me, one of my biggest triggers is when I watch groups of people being violent and destructive to other groups of people. I'm the one yelling at the TV during the news, right? And I just have to go, those humans, how do I keep seeing what's underneath and going, how are those people shaped in a way that they're participating in violating other people? Right. It's to me, these are deep contemplations. But that's the first thing, is what capacities do we need to keep cultivating to be deeply, fully human and to be with the complexities of our world without either going into denial or going into total reaction? That, to me, that's a spiritual question, really. Right. The second piece is, what do we long for? What I love about somatics, what I love about embodied transformation is, the first question is, what do you want? What do you long for? Who do you want to become? And in many ways, we're just scaling that question up and going, who do we want to become? Right? Who do we want to become? What do we long for? And if what we long for is power with, let's say, a connection to the stars and a connection to the earth, I keep thinking about, like, three generations out, I want to feel proud I won't be alive anymore, but I want to feel proud. I might be, I guess, and to hand over, like, look at what we transformed. We got to hand over an intact atmosphere. We got to hand over water and everyone has access to clean water. We got to hand over that we know how to produce our food in a way that's good for the soil and deeply good for our bodies. And everyone's fed. Like, I want to feel proud, right? Right now, I don't feel proud. I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, how do we go through this transformation collectively? So what do we long for? And then scale that up to go, what do we want to hand over with the environment, with the economy, with our how we organize our societies. You know this from somatics. We are pack animals. Humans live in towns or tribes or cities. So how do we want to be in our societies where there is everybody's fed? There's a lot of room for everyone to become fully human, no matter what your gender is, right? So that's the second thing to me, is what do we want? And really to let ourselves exercise that muscle from the personal to the interpersonal to the social. And then I can't remember your other question, so remind me.
Well, I mean, I this is basically answering it. You know, I was asking, like, how can we,
how do we do it?
This, yeah, essentially.
Yeah.
Before you, what I'm struck by, yeah. What I love about this is, what am I for as well? What am I longing for? So it's not just what am I against. And I think what one insight I had was, I was like, oh, I think what I'm standing for is like a non-pathologizing, but not non-discerning stance, like
I'm
not going to, so it's like, because it's so easy to move into a frequency, like an embodied stance of like making wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do it every day, all the time, less these days, but it's like, it's a subtle contraction and it's now I've made something that's happened wrong. And that, the less I do that, the more I feel joy, the more I feel love and connection, intimacy. But that doesn't mean not being discerning, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, it's just so good because I think discernment is a beautiful word. And I want to even challenge both of us. Like, what is it like not only to practice discernment without making bad? But also discernment and not reacting to someone else making us bad, right? To me, I think that's one of the big things is like, how do I have a big enough vision that when someone is making me bad or maybe giving me grounded critical feedback, because that also happens where I'm like, I can feel reactive to grounded critical feedback too. But let's say someone's making me bad and I'm like, that's ungrounded. How do I stay generous of heart? Even in that moment, right?
How do you? What did you do in this moment?
I just feel like I've done a lot of, like, one, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I get totally reactive, right? But when I think about what is the deep internal work, one is I have a very strong vision to come back to because I'm very connected to my longing. And I'm like, okay, wait a second. What do I long for? I can make space for this energy. Based on what I like, this longing I have for people, for the future, I can just be like, oh, that person's actually hurting. What are they hurting about? Right? But I've also had to do a lot of work. I mean, you know this, but I'm a survivor of sexual violence that left me with a lot of shame. And I've had to do a lot of work on my own shame. Because I'll tell you, when my shame gets triggered, I go into a lot of like, how do I prove that I belong? How do I prove that I'm worthy? How do I prove, right? It kicks all of that natural protection off. So I notice that if that's going off, I notice I need more support. It's like, okay, this is really loud and strong. Let me actually get more support before I respond to this situation so I don't react to it. And one other thing I want to say there is I sometimes think we have really high expectations of people or groups of people who've been really, really hurt. We have these high expectations that they should act perfectly. They should ask for social change in a perfect way that's not offensive. And sometimes I go, wait a second, these are whole groups of trauma survivors. Can we just be a little bit more compassionate? Right? Like, I was having a conversation with another friend of mine and like, I love him. We're in lifelong committed connection. And he was like, why do people who survive violence have to be so cranky about it, have to be so mad, and particularly women? And I was like, hold on. being mad is a totally healthy response to having been violated. And it might not be easy for you to be on the other side of, and maybe you need to step out of the way a little bit when people are really mad. But is that also a place where you can bring your compassion and understanding without getting right in the line of fire? We just had a really good conversation about who do we want to be as people, right? And when are the times to discern, I need to step aside because this is too triggering, or I can hold a space of compassion until together we can shift the quality of the conversation.
Yeah. It seems like in our times, one of the things that's, maybe this is a wish that I have, but I hear it in your story, and I see it in mine. It's like this commitment to taking responsibility for one's experience. And I don't mean by that that you're responsible for violence that has happened to you in any way, but that you can take responsibility for what happens afterwards. And at the same time, not to make people wrong for not doing that, but it does seem like there are more people, you know, I think that's what coaching is about a lot of time, is like the self-awareness to start to look inside and see how one has been shaped by society and our families. And that brings compassion, but also, right, you know, opens up space for choice and a different, right, response. So it leaves me feeling, I don't know if hopeful is the right word, but at least inspired about now being a time where there could be a new wave of, and activism is a word I've kind of moved away from using, but maybe it's time to reclaim that. And I just want to bring in like one more, or another area of exploration is like around this longing. Someone, Marvin Oka, who came on our podcast recently, shared this beautiful, and I'm not going to be able to paraphrase the quote of Gandhi, who said, like, I feel the spirit of India in me, you know, moving me. And I thought that was just so incredible, because like he was taking responsibility for India, but also
exactly
moved by the spirit, almost like his soma had, yep, expanded to feel and, yep, be moved by the spirit of India. And I was like, I mean, it almost moves me to tears, you know? That is so profound.
That's like, beautiful.
So I guess that's like teeing up this question of like, how can we open our sphere of concern to be moved by spirit, beautiful, in a way that, you know, that allows us to be a force in the world.
Exactly. This is so great. I just, you know, when you said one of the things about embodied transformation or coaching is it brings us to a place of more like centered responsibility, or like being able to respond instead of react, being able to grow, being able to take action toward a vision, right? And then the next, to me, natural layer of is exactly what you said, is like, what is it like to go, actually want to be in a place of responsibility for the comments. Like, I want to be in a place of responsibility for my moment in history or our shared world. And while that can sound like so heavy and I don't know how to do that, it, to me, it can actually be profoundly freeing and spiritually freeing, because I do think we're profoundly interdependent. I think there's a truth, or the energy of that truth, that is just so energizing. And I don't know about you, but I know when I've gone, what are my longings for myself or for my family or my community? But when I let myself really go, what are my longings for the world? The amount of energy that's available, the like depth of the guidance. I mean, between you and me and I guess the podcast listeners, I feel like my draw toward healing or somatics and my draw toward social change are both spiritual draws. I feel like my spiritual connection has said, you, me, must transform to become more whole and do the gritty work of that, because it's not always fun, as we know. And right next to it is this longing for a world of power with, a world of right relationship with the planet, a world where we can all be more whole and free. And then there's just different processes of how to engage that transformation.
Yeah, I relate to that very much. You know, even talking about it, you know, even naming Gandhi's, you know, the spirit of India, you know, it I feel an expansion and a deeper connection to my heart and an intimacy that feels very enlivening and empowering. And so,
can I add one more thing there? You know, I often will ask myself or clients this question: is like, what future is important enough that you're willing to risk something for it? Right? Like when I look at big change or initiation, or we all take risks to change, right? We all take risks to transform. But really, like, what future is compelling enough? What vision is compelling enough to risk change, right? Or to leverage our courage for? I think about it that way too. Yeah. You keep asking me about social change and I keep not answering. Were you about to go there?
It is on my mind, but let me ask this first. That vision that we take a risk for, would you say then that becomes something we embody? Because like we don't know what the future will be like. You know, in a way, we're imagining something, and it's like in an imaginary future. But I think where it gets interesting for me is that's who we can become right now.
Exactly. I mean, this is the best of somatics, as we keep practicing embodying, centering with a vision. So that vision is really becoming part of our muscle memory, or becoming part of our nervous system. You know, we can look at so many different social change leaders like Gandhi or like Rosa Parks or like Martin Luther King. And I sometimes go, why did that I Have a Dream speech become so globally popular? And it's really him speaking a vision for all of us. And you could feel how congruent it was inside of him, right? I mean, he's an amazing orator also. But he was really going, here's the vision I want to live toward, which is really what we're doing inside of somatics too, is like, what's the longing? Let me find it deeply in my soma. Let me craft it and have a phrase, and then let me practice it every day. So it's really what's imbuing my thoughts, emotions, and actions, right? Guiding my relationships.
Maybe that is a good segue, because, you know, I've heard people say, like, I think there was a Buckminster Fuller who said, like, you know, don't fight against the old systems, like design new ones that are just so compelling that that's what people just naturally gravitate towards. So could you say something about social change itself? You know, I know you've critiqued, like, if we only focus on individual change, that may be not enough. And the relationship between our longing and this vision and then enacting social change.
Awesome. It's funny, I've moved away from the word activist too, but some people love it. For some people, somas, that word totally fits. So I just want to be as flexible as we can. So the first thing is this question about what's the longing for the we? What's the longing for the commons? What's the longing for the earth or for future generations? To me, those are the questions to take into our daily practice until we have a really easy answer for them. So for me, one of the hardest has been like, oh my God, our global economy, what do we want instead? Because it works for a few people, but it doesn't work for all people, and definitely is not working for the earth, right? So there's an organization called Movement Generation, and they've developed this beautiful vision of a regenerative economy, right? So anyway, first asking those questions until we have answers, right? And that means asking other people, going to the people who studied economies or social norms or the environment, really learning until our longings have articulations, right? And then taking some of our time and putting our time toward what we long for the we. So if what someone longs for is that there's clean water for everyone, either in my country, my community, it's a great spend 5 hours a month participating with organizations that are already working toward that. Or like get elected to your local water board. Or do you know what I mean? Like practice for the we, practice toward the vision for the we. So in the outer work project, it's why we're gathering so many different types of social change organizations that have a positive vision. Now, that doesn't mean they don't sometimes say stop. Because if there's a lot of harm, we want to say stop to the harm so we can move toward this vision. But again, if we say, there's a lot of people in the U.S. now that really want a social democracy, that are saying, we're willing to pay more taxes so that everyone has health care. We really want there to be a resource distribution that takes care of everyone. So the class divide isn't going like this, isn't spreading more intensely, right? So let's say someone comes through the program and that's what they want. It's like, great. Let's say they have 10 hours a month, which is like 2.5 hours a week that they're going to dedicate toward that. Here's a local organization or a statewide organization or a national organization that that's exactly what they're focused on. And then they can go spend their time there and participate in collectively making that happen. I personally think, Joel, that the more, especially as we're adults, the more we work for collective well-being, the more spiritually satisfied we are. The more we work for collective well-being, it's like there's new challenges and possibilities for growth. We become more human, more adult, wiser, right? Whatever the words are that resonate for people. But, you know, I contemplate a lot also about death and dying and do a lot of reading around death and dying, and actually spent 5 months. My mom was at my house. She hospiced at my house, and I really was part of being with her through that very intimate process. And again and again, what we're shown is at the end, people are going, how are my relationships? Like, did I love and was I loved? And did I make a difference? Like, those are some of the core things that we're asking at the end. And I think that piece about did I make a difference is a lot about did I make a difference in something bigger than my own life? And that can be for another person. And there's a way that it could be for our community, the environment, our nations, or for the world.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You know, I feel like the conditions are so ripe right now because our systems are so perturbed. And,
yes,
you know, it's very uncomfortable. When I was talking to a systems thinker, but they said, but the good news about systems being perturbed is like that's when second order transformation can occur. You know, when everything's more stable, it's much more difficult. So I see a massive interest I think what's happening is people are asking these deeper questions with AI coming in as well. What is it to be human? And, you know, what is it to live a life of meaning? What is it to live a good life? And I don't think hope is the right word because I don't know how things will turn out, but mm-hmm. I know I feel more inspired than ever. And it just feels like the time for hesitation has passed. You know, this,
it's a beautiful way to say it.
But not in any kind of, necessarily panicked like
way,
heroic.
Not in a panicked way. Exactly.
Yeah. It's just like, there's a kind of joy inside of that mm-hmm. for me, which, so
I love that you say the word perturbed. I think it's a beautiful way to think about it. And I want to relate that to somatics because we know we have these deep embodied habits that served safety, belonging, and dignity, right? In this line of somatics, we call it conditioned tendencies, right? But it gets called different things, like what a part might be taken care of. And when we go into transformation, we're perturbed. We're like, wait, what was familiar, even though it wasn't working, it's known, right? Then we get perturbed and we need to keep transforming toward our longing, taking on the new practices and getting through the unstable time, but toward the vision. And what we know the risk is, personally in personal transformation, but societally, is sometimes during the perturbation, the pulling back to the old, what's known, even though it wasn't working, is a very strong call. And I feel like we see that happening. There's a very strong fight for power over, a really strong fight for like right is might, right? There's a lot of that going on. And it, to me, it's a pull for the old way. But I agree with you. I think a lot of us are going, no, no, there's something else possible right now for people, for the economy, for the earth. And I would call it the power with, like really going for a different way to organize ourselves, our societies, our economy, for that quality of collective well-being. But I think the perturbation and somatically, how do we keep discerning amidst perturbation? How do we keep going? What do I long for me and for us during perturbation? And not just be kind of slapped around by the news cycle, which is so easy to do, or just turn it off and go, that is too much. I'm going to turn it off and I'm only going to calm my own nervous system. And again, both of those are understandable reactions, but given the level of internal work we've done, how do we bring that regulated nervous system and choices and self-cultivation to the external perturbation and then consciously get engaged in the outer work at 5 hours a month, 20 hours a month, maybe you're retired and you can do 40 hours a month, who knows, but get engaged for the collective well-being along a line that, you know, that lines up with what you care about and is really for a power with future.
Yeah. So Stacey, I think, first of all, I really appreciate this conversation. I think these are exactly the kinds of inquiries we need to be having right now. It really touches a sweet spot for me of you know, the need for this kind of work, for coaches, for people interested in what does it take to kind of create a better world with others, power with others, you know, in that journey. And there's so many powerful lessons for me that I'm going to take away. So I just want to thank you for, is there anything you want to share as a closing? I mean, I'm going to invite you in a moment to share where we can find out more about the project, but is there anything you want to end by saying?
I think I first want to thank you just for your openness, the risks you took, and how just transparent you were and willing to like engage this. I feel like we just engage very complex, sometimes triggering or polarizing terrain for like an hour. And we're here, we're connected, we're growing together, we're learning together, you know? I'm like, yes, let's do more of this together. So thank you. And I think especially for the coaching community, I so deeply appreciate the depth of internal work, right? Like the self-cultivation, the how do people transform? There's just such rich wisdom here. And then what I want to invite us into is keep going from the I to the we. Like if the we were well, if everyone had access, if, you know, to just go to like, what's our longing for the we? What's my longing for the we? And then how do I get to also be responsible for and discerning of the we? To me, the more of us who do that, who have a ground of internal work, the better all this is going to go.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. And where can we find out more about the project? And I know you have a kind of kickoff coming up soon.
Yeah. So you can find it at theouterwork.org. It's going to be a nonprofit project. We launch in July, and it'll be an online program, with 8 modules, again, nonprofit. And then people will be in pods, like support and learning pods of 10, based on actually where you live. So there's a possibility of you could even meet in person. Those pods will be like 12 pod meetings. There's just a lot of resources, support. And again, the journey is going from the inner work to learning how social change happens and engaging the outer work with bringing all that inner work along with you. Yeah, so it's like the both and.
Excellent. Yeah, I really hope people come and check that out and join you. And so, yeah, till next time, I feel like we could do a part two, actually, some point around this topic. So
I love it. It's great. Just thank you. Thank you. Great to be connected.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training with Jim Dethmer and Bob Anderson. It's called Unlocking Leaders, and it's going to teach you how to coach at the level of consciousness, which is, for me, the highest leverage move you can make as a coach. Your client's consciousness is the place where the deepest, truest transformational breakthroughs come from. And often traditional coaching misses this, and it's something that our clients need us to learn as coaches. Because our times are calling for something deeper. We've got to go beneath the content of our experience, beneath strategy, to the source of change. And that's exactly what Unlocking Leaders is designed to teach you. I'm so proud of this program, of what it's become. I feel it's our offering in these times. And if you're ready to answer the call of these times, then you can join the full program. So just head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by 29th of May. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.